Well, I was born in Chicago, and that made a big difference in my life, because when I was born there, it was a great jazz town. Chicago is known as Second City, as you probably have heard, you know, with all the actors and things. But it's actually Second City when it comes to jazz, because after they closed all the brothels in New Orleans because of the Navy's problem with disease, why, they all came to Chicago. And I just mentioned on the show I did now that I had eye-to-eye contact with Jimmy Noone, this great clarinetist. It was kind of awful for him. It was a bar, the Three Deuces. There's nobody in it. The bartender was cleaning glasses, and I heard this clarinet. So I wandered in, and lo and behold, there's Jimmy Noone. But it was like that in Chicago at the time. You'd see a lot of jazz musicians on the streets. But the thing is, it had to do with radio, too. You know, radio was different back then. Now it's not hate radio or, you know, talk radio. It was entertainment. And when I was 8 years old, I heard Louis Armstrong play the trumpet, and I heard Fats Waller play the piano and sing. And I thought, who are these guys? And so I found out about Louis, and I really loved his playing. I thought, this is fantastic. So I ran upstairs and got my father's cornet and started to teach myself to play cornet. And well, I got pretty good after a while, and I was invited by the local high school jazz band to play in a band. And they liked me because I could improvise without getting lost. And I'm amazed to know today that even pros get lost. But anyway, so I've had this experience playing too. But along with that, I got this great love of the American Songbook. And I thought, gee, these tunes are great. And I was fascinated by the harmonies. Louis knows this because I think he was in one of my harmony classes. And there's nothing like a great chord progression. And I had a teacher finally at Northwestern who had the same attitude. He would say, isn't this a delicious chord progression? And I love that guy, and we got along very well. But there's another story. I've been very lucky because I've sort of backed into things. I didn't push myself, like getting into the high school band. I was referred to the band by somebody else who heard me play once. And so I've been very lucky in that regard. And so anyway, I had a friend who, sadly, who died about a month ago, who wrote a book on Gershwin. Actually, he was later on when he came to California, and he was very close to Ira Gershwin, and got us autographed copies of his books and that sort of thing. But when he was my age, we were all out of the military at that time, about three of us. And I met him on a Saturday afternoon, and he had been in the Navy V-12 program, and said, and so he knew something about academe, because that was what you did if you were in Navy V-12. Well, I, since I was going to go to college, I wanted to use the GI Bill. He said, "Why don't you go to Northwestern? It's only 12 miles from here. We could commute, and we could save a lot of money." Well, that's a Midwestern argument. Frugality is everything. And so I did it, but it changed my life. I had this wonderful teacher, as I mentioned, who loved chords. But by the time I got to that point, I actually was experimenting with doing big band arrangements. It was very primitive at the beginning. I had a pianist, and I was on trumpet, and then I had a saxophone player, and I would try with just these two horns and a piano to find the right sounds for the tunes I was doing, because they're very intricate. People don't realize how wonderful, well, some people nowadays, you know, the people who play in the three guitar, three chord bands, they don't know these things, but they're terrific songs. I have a grandson now. I'm trying to get him interested in playing these tunes. He's got a teacher who's trying to get him into it, too. But it's tough, you know. I mean, these are very intricate things. But anyway, I started learning finally how to do that. So in this band I was playing in high school, I started writing arrangements. And so when the guy who had started that band was called up for military duty, why, I was elected leader of the band, and I sort of never got over that, you know. But it was very interesting. It was a great experience. I did my arrangements and played them, played trumpet, did the trumpet solos, and we rehearsed at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Park Ridge, Illinois, which is Hillary Clinton's hometown. I don't know if you knew that. But anyway, Father Hubbard, who ran the church, really loved young people. So after the church thing was over at about 3 p.m. on a Sunday, we got to rehearse there for a couple of hours. And every Friday, but the catch was, we had to play for dances in the church social hall on Friday nights. But that was great. The funny thing is, it was for young people. And they all came, but their parents came too. and so we became very, I got to be known by a lot of people in the area. So even later on, people remember me from having played with these in this situation. But anyway, Northwestern turned out to be a big boon. It just opened the world to me I didn't know anything about. I was the first in my family to go to college. And I was just so lucky because I had these great teachers. But I didn't think I could make it as a music major. And I started out in speech school. I thought maybe I could become a radio announcer. And I didn't get to do that till now. But anyway, I did my thing, and then I met a guy from Fort Wayne, Indiana, who was in the music school. And we exchanged experiences as players. He said, you know, you really ought to be in music school. You could be a music theory major. So I thought about that. And that's really where my heart was, but I didn't know there was a field called music theory. But I went over, and fortunately I had this wonderful guy. His name was Frank Cookson. He was a composer, but not well known. He did a lot of choral music, which was very successful. But I really got to love this guy, and we became very familiar. And Northwestern were the people weren't great producers of research, but they were really great teachers. So that really worked in my favor. And so anyway, I was in a composition class that he did. It was a beginner's composition class, writing music. Well, he wanted us to write a piece based on somebody else's piece. Well, I didn't know that much of the literature at the time, but I knew the music of Samuel Barber and the Adagio for Strings. So I started with a kind of paraphrase of the Adagio for Strings, much simpler. Anyway, the guys who, the teachers liked it so much, they wanted me to enter it and go to contest. I said, I don't think so, you know. But anyway, That was my first recognition as a composer. But then I continued on, and eventually I got my master's degree in composition, and I wrote a piece which was fairly simple. I like to write with as few encumbrances as possible. And so I wrote my master's thesis for flute, clarinet, timpani, and strings. Well, that was a good move, because one of my buddies at Northwestern, a guy by the name of John Kakavas, who later became a composer in Hollywood, he always wanted to be, you know, a, commercial musician, and he made it in Hollywood. He did the music for the Kojak show, for example, among other things. But he was very much in contact with the people at NBC, where there was at that time a 45-piece orchestra. Well, that was just perfect for my composition for, you know, a small group of woodwinds which they had available and a string section. So I got it performed on NBC on a network that would have been 1951, I guess. I was in Austria at the time starting my study abroad, and I wasn't around. But later on I heard it, and it was very nice to have a performance. Well, my teacher in Austria, a wonderful guy I was expecting when I went to Austria on a Fulbright, that I'd run into these arrogant composers in Austria, you know, the height of everything. But this guy was one of the sweetest people in the world, and he liked me. I was his first American student. He arrived at the Academy of Music at the same time I did. And so we became not just close, but good friends. Well, a few years later, he took my place here at UCR when I was on leave, and my colleagues got to know him. I don't know if you ever met him. His name was Carl Schiske, and a great composer. Well, he liked my stuff, so he suggested, I had written two organ pieces. I was very much into organ because my brother was an organist. And I found out something very interesting about that. When you write for organ, you're not writing for one instrument. You're writing for any number of instruments because all organs are different. They all have opus numbers. When I would travel with my brother, he'd get these church jobs in the north side of Chicago, and I'd have to drive him. I'd recognize it. Gee, he played that tune a couple of weeks ago, and it sounded different, you know. And it's sort of like jazz. And when I was doing these organ pieces, I thought, why am I enjoying this so much? And I realized it's because I'd done big band arrangements, which is trying to do something different with great songs, in the case of the organ, hymn tunes. So anyway, that was really something that was a revelation to me. But anyway, my teacher liked my stuff, two organ pieces and my master's thesis from Northwestern. He had them published by a publisher in Vienna. Those pieces and two others, the clarinet piece, solo clarinet piece, and a quartet I arranged for my brass ensemble here at UCR. Those are the only pieces that are still in print of the ones I had published. So I've been lucky in all these things. Probably the greatest thing that happened to me was coming to Riverside. When I came, there were a lot of guys who wanted to move on in bigger schools. So they would quit here and move on to Washington University in St. Louis or someplace in the East, Indiana or someplace, and then try to get into Stanford. One of them did. I met him on the Queen Mary going over to Austria, and we've been friends ever since. He married a Riverside girl, very, very impressive guy. But he also liked music a lot, so we did a lot of traveling together and so on. But anyway, I've been very lucky in this regard that these things have been picked up. I've been aided by these guys. Well, I had another experience like that when I joined the local musicological society. I went to a meeting over in Claremont one day, and I met a guy from L.A. by the name of, I can't think of his name now, but he did the choir at the Wilshire Presbyterian Church, which had a terrific organist by the name of Rainer Brown. He's very well respected in music circles. Everybody in town knew him. He occasionally played in the studios and so on, so a lot of the different people got to know him. But he's a terrific guy and a nice man. Well, I was talking to Bob, this guy, casually, and he said, "Well, what do you do?" We were talking around the table. I said, "Well, I'm a music theorist." "Oh? And, well, I do some writing, too." "What do you write?" "Well, lately I've been writing some organ music." And he said, "You have? What have you written?" I said, "Well, I did 3 preludes on some of my favorite hymn tunes, which were very attractive tunes for doing something with." He said, "You ought to send them to Rainer Brown. He's starting a publication series." Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I sent these things off. Rainer Brown was very happy to have them. They were the first thing they published in this series. So, you know, I've had these experiences like this. So I don't have any complaints, you know. And I ended up here in Riverside, which is a town. When I came here, it was 88,000. But it felt like a small Midwestern town. And I think to some extent it still does. And I like that. You know, I didn't want to. I figure if I have to conquer the world on behalf of the university to get promoted, I'll do it from Riverside. And I've been very lucky in that regard. My first article, was about Stravinsky, because as a music theorist, I found out that Stravinsky, the second movement of Stravinsky's Sonata for 2 Pianos, it was a variation movement, was not like most variation movements. And I was going to teach it in a class I was teaching. I thought, what am I going to do? I'm dumbfounded. What's going on here? So I started counting notes. And I found that Stravinsky had put together a 28-tone row, which was consistent throughout this one variation. So I wrote this article, An Early Serial Idea of Stravinsky. Well, I sent it off to the Musical Quarterly, which had published some of my analyses of pieces I'd heard in concerts in Vienna. And the editor had just put out an issue on Stravinsky. He says, "I'm sorry, but we'll have to leave that go for a while, you know." So I sent it off to the Music Review in England. They took it, did a terrific job on it with fold-out pages for graphs and that sort of thing. So immediately I became a world name. So I've been very lucky in all these things. But I really had wonderful colleagues here at Riverside. My best friend was William Reynolds, who for 40 years conducted the choral groups here. And as an aside, our children got to know each other, and my daughter married his oldest son, who is now the president of the American Musicological Society, and just won a big prize for his teaching and research up at Davis. So I just had these wonderful people around. I guess if you're lucky, and that's one of the things about Riverside, I don't know about the department now, it seems a little strange to me. But at that time, we had wonderful contacts with one another, and you could rely on the expertise of the people and help you out when you had a problem. So it's just been a lucky thing for me all along. And then I have to add my second career, thanks to Lewis. He gets embarrassed every time I mention this, but I had retired in 1991, and 2 years later, after I had a medical problem and taken care of that, Lewis called me out of the clear blue and said, "Could you do a show?" And I said, "Let me think about it, Lewis." So I was talking to my daughter, and she said, immediately, "Oh, Papa, that's a good way for you to keep your hand in education." Well, I have to say, the education has been mine. I mean, I've discovered all these really wonderful jazz fans here in the Inland Empire, and I've had really wild experiences, like 4 million to 1. One of them was a band leader in Texas who called me up after one of my shows. And I didn't believe that it was him, but I realized afterward it was. His name is Pete Peterson. And he asked me, "Where did you get that version of the theme you used, Little Darling? And I said, "Well, it's very difficult because I got it on an old recording in a series called the Dedication Series on ABC Records." I said, "But that's all I know." And then he said, what was the name of that tune that you did, played by the John Dankworth band?" I said, "Oh, that was Toots Thielemann's wonderful song called Song for My Lady." And so that was that. But I realized this is this guy who runs a band in Dallas, Texas. But more recently, this is a biggie. I had played Johnny Hartman, the singer, doing Almost Like Being in Love. It's a tune I've always liked. And when I had my big band in college, and a really good big band, and I always wanted to sing it with my band, but I never got around to writing an arrangement. But then I heard Johnny Hartman do it. I put it on the show. A week later, in my slot over here, was a message from Mike Barone, who runs a big band in Los Angeles. And a very nice man. But he sent a cryptic little note. He said, "You played Johnny Hartman. I wrote that arrangement." And he was so enamored of this, he sent me one of his recordings. And he sent me other recordings later, because I played some of his stuff. He's a terrific musician. He's almost totally self-taught. But he played trombone in the West Point band, and then ran a big band in Germany for the military. But he now has this rehearsal band in Los Angeles, but they play an occasional gig, like at the Lighthouse. Well, he kept sending me more recordings, and so I got to know him pretty well. Well, a year ago, in June it'll be a year ago, he had a recording session over at Glendora College or Citrus College in Glendora. And he invited me and some friends of mine to sit in on the session. Well, on some of his other recordings, he had people in the room who applauded. And I thought he's going to do the same thing here. But the three of us were the only non-members of the band. So I've got to know him pretty well. And his wife, and this sort of thing, this is wild, I think, when this happens, because our station is only, 150 watts, and you don't expect this to happen, but it did, and I'm very grateful for it. So, and not only that, he treated me as a professional, because I knew what he was talking about. And I met members of his band who were very, very nice guys. And a couple of them knew Steve Carr. Do you remember Steve Carr? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he works in L.A. as a musician. So, these guys had a relationship with me there. But I also met a trombonist by the name of Charlie Loper. I was standing before the Lighthouse opened when I went with Lee Farley. A couple of other people. I was standing next to this white-haired man. I was talking to one of these guys who knew Steve Carr, and I saw this trombone case, and I tapped him on the shoulder, says, "Are you Charlie Loper?" And he smiled. He's the guy who plays first trombone. How many times do somebody come up to you and say, "Are you Charlie Loper?" And it turned out to be a wonderful man. And it says something to me about the nature of musicians. Andre Previn once said, "Musicians are the nicest people in the world, and jazz musicians are the nicest of all." There are exceptions, of course. There's some pretty bad jazz musicians, too. But I'm just so grateful for music. I got an email today from a friend of mine who happens to be Hawaiian, but he was an assistant principal at Pauley High School. And it was a band that was from Paraguay, in a town spelled, what, C-E-U-T-R-E or something like that. And this town is built on a rubbish heap, literally. And so music was so strong, these kids were starting to make instruments. They had pictures of these instruments. You know, a cello made out of something. Have you seen this thing?
I've seen
it. Yeah, it's really incredible. Suddenly they're playing this music. And so I'm just so glad I made my change from speech school to music school. Even though when I was in speech school, Jerry Orbach, I don't know if you remember his name, he was a student there. And Northwestern has had a lot of very well-known students. But anyway, so I made a lot of good choices, I think. And not only that, I have a family. I hate to say this, but my whole family has PhDs. It's sort of dreadful in a way. I wish they would be lawyers or something like that. But anyway, they're a nice bunch, and I've enjoyed them immensely. So I've had a really great life, and it's been capped by doing this show. Because, as I say, I've learned a lot about doing the show. And for example, I in 1971, I had a sabbatical leave. And I was in the habit of buying a new Volkswagen when I went to Germany and eventually to Austria. So I'd picked up the Volkswagen in Frankfurt, started south toward Heidelberg, and I tried out the radio. Well, it had the usual broadcast band on the radio, but just above it was a different band, some kind of a European band or something. I could only hear one station, and it was the French radio. Well, what were they playing? They were playing Count Basie, playing a piece I didn't know, but when I came back to Riverside, one of my trumpet players, Mike Donovan, who was a real hip kid, and I sang it for him because it was such a catchy tune. I remembered it. It has a lot of repeated notes, which you're not supposed to do usually, but he did this so well, the composer. It turned out to be Neil Hefti. If you know his name. Well, Neil Hefti is from Hastings, Nebraska. And I thought, what an interesting confluence or conflation. A French disc jockey, Count Basie, Neil Hefti from Hastings, Nebraska. If ever there was proof of the dissemination of jazz and how power it has with everybody, that was it. Well, one of the things that really impressed me, I may have mentioned this on the show today, I'm not sure, but my wife met a lot of interesting people in Europe and students. And the one was an art historian who worked at a radio station in Ljubljana, which is the capital of Slovenia. And I met her through my wife one day when she was visiting in Vienna. And I was about to come back to the United States. She says, why don't you swing down to Slovenia? So, and I said, well, that sounds good. You know, every morning in my room in Vienna, I listen to a program with the Slovenian big band, the big band in Ljubljana. So he says, well, come on down and you can hear some more of it. So I did, and when I came out of the train station, what was playing but Glenn Miller doing In the Mood or something. And so I visited this radio station, and this wonderful little man, he's only about 4'7" or something like that, but he gave me this whole bunch of tapes of the Slovenian big band to listen to. But it goes on like this, no matter where you go. I don't know his first name, but Thoreau, the writer, do you know him?
Henry Thoreau.
He described sitting in a cafe in Singapore, And he said, I was sitting there drinking my coffee, and suddenly I realized I'm hearing American jazz on the music. So it has really conquered the world. And anyway, I was going to end with a one-liner here, and I think I may have forgotten it. It has something to do with Lewis.
Well, let me ask you, what makes jazz special? What is jazz? Is music? It's part of the world of music.
Well, it's like classical music. It's serious music. And this is why it appeals to Europeans. They're better off than we are when it comes to the arts. They really think the arts are important. For us, they are just frills, and that's really sad. It's the thing that's killing our country. But they take it very seriously, and for example, there's a guy. I was a big listener of the Austrian radio show, jazz show. It's on every night from 11 to 2 in the morning, but on the weekend, it's from 11 to 3. So I was listening to it on the weekend, and they were going to give away a free record for somebody who could answer a question. So they were playing Lucky Millinder's band, and Dizzy Gillespie was playing on it at the time, and he wrote a piece called Little John Special. And at the end of that, you get this da 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 da, and very very familiar to jazz lovers. So they said, okay, anybody you recognize this is going to get the record. So some guy calls from the total west of Austria, Vorarlberg, and he said, das ist das sogenannte Salt Peanuts. I mean, you can't escape this. These people are informed. And, you know, if this guy were on somebody on Jeopardy, I don't think they'd get the answer. But, no, it's just great running into these people. And, of course, Joe Zawinul, whose name I'm sure you know, you know, he was one of Ortiz's greatest exports. And but before he came to America, I saw him once. He's playing with a dance band, and I went with some friends during my... I spent 2 years in Austria, and in the summer between, I went to hear the Horst Winter band. Horst Winter was a very good singer, but he's a totally trained musician. And he has this band, and here's this young guy about 20 years old. He's already losing his hair, and he was playing with this band. And I found out it later it was Joe Zawinul. And 7 years later, he came to the United States. And because he knew so much about music, was so practiced in jazz, why, he had no problems. First thing you know, he's playing with Maynard Ferguson. Then he's accompanying Diane Washington. And then he did a stint with Cannonball Adderley. And he tells this amusing story of his mother meeting Cannonball Adderley. He invited Cannonball over to the house when they played Vienna. And he said she didn't know any German or any English, and he didn't know any German. She says, but they got along just fine. Because he liked her food. But it's a real icebreaker. If you you know, there are too few jazz fans in this country, sad to say. But when you go to Europe, why, it's a totally different thing. But the thing is, jazz, like classical music, requires you to bring something to it. You cannot enjoy classical music if you don't know something about the nature of classical music and what it is you're supposed to listen to. And jazz is the same way. I know a lot of people just hate jazz, but I happen to like it because I grew up with it, I played it, and to me, And besides, jazz introduced the whole idea of bringing back the wind band. And so you get a flurry of woodwind quintets written by any number of composers. My favorite one is by Paul Hindemith, the French composer. He wrote one of the best wind quintets in the world. And it was all sort of it comes from the jazz thing of the hard sound of wind instruments. So anyway, it's also a place where a good trumpet player can get something to play. If you look at the classical orchestra, you know, the trumpets only, well, I'm exaggerating, trumpets only play when the timpani come in, you know, but it's, and it just gives a good player, if he likes to improvise, a chance to do something different. But, I'm very grateful to having grown up in a small town in the Midwest. And I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in a lily-white town about 15 miles from the Loop in Chicago. And I went to the local music store. I ordered a Count Basie recording. She says, "Well, we don't handle those. I'll have to special order it for you." That was the kind of town I grew up in which the Italians were the ones who were doing all the grunt work at that time. Well, several years later, I went back to a meeting in Chicago, and I thought I'd go and drive out to see how my parents' old house looked. Well, the house looked great, but one thing I noticed driving out from Chicago, it's about 60 miles away, all the car agencies were owned by Italians, and I was saying, well, some progress has been made. Some student came up to me after I was doing one of the shows, and he says, where did you learn all this stuff? You know, and I don't know if I told him. I said, well, I grew up with it, and it was part of my life, and I just, you know, I absorbed it. Of course, I read Downbeat magazine early on, too. I forget if they started publishing in 1934 or a little later, but when I think about 1937, I started reading Downbeat regularly. It came out every Thursday night in Chicago, and so I would be downtown, and I'd pick up a copy, and I absorbed all that stuff. You know, some of it was flaky, pap, you know, and the press agentry and so on, but it all stuck, you know, and for example, I can still remember Count Basie getting a guy released from prison who had murdered somebody, and he promised to try to turn him into a law-abiding citizen. Well, a week after he was released, he shot somebody else. So these things happen, yeah.
I just want to tell you, Dr. J, that you were my favorite professor.
Lewis, you're so kind.
Well, you were my favorite professor as a student here at UCR, and to have you doing a radio show is just absolutely
great.
In
my old age, you were one of my favorite students, Lewis, and I was very impressed. My second show, I finally found this version of Little Darlin' that I used. The first one was the conventional one that was written by Neil Hefti. But the second one I found had been altered by Sammy Nestico, the arranger, and Count Basie. Basie wanted to change some of these things. What a lot of people don't realize is Basie was really trying to perfect things. He tampered with them. After all, he played the same tunes practically every night for, 60 years or something. But nobody seems to realize is he's always trying to perfect them. If you look at different versions of the 1 o'clock jump, it's amazing how it goes through. But there's one riff that survived them all. And that was very interesting. It was the introduction to a tune called Well, it was done by the Chocolate Dandies, 1928. Anyway, the tune is da 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 da. That tune was the introduction to this tune. Oh, it's called Four or Five Times is the name of the tune, written by Fats Waller. And so Count Basie was playing in Kansas City, and he said he was going to do something different on the 1 o'clock jump, because he played it all the time. And he said, he yelled at the first alto sax player, get ready to do something. I'm going to modulate the D flat. So he did his modulation, and up comes this da 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 da, da. And that was the beginning of that. But in the final version of the 1 o'clock jump, which Basie ordered from Ernie Wilkins, the arranger, to put together, what do you hear after the bass solo? Da 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 da. That's the one that really lives. So it made me think that Basie really had something in mind, you know. He wasn't just a band leader who plays the same thing again and again. But so anyway, I'm very grateful to you, Lewis, for having the opportunity to do this second career. I've run into so many people, and, you know, people wander into the studio. A nice man by the name of Dennis Whitman came in today, very quiet man, and he says, I've been listening to your show for 7 years, and I'd like to give you, he gave me a recording of Lyle Hampton doing one I didn't have, with a lot of different bands that he'd played with. And this happens again and again, you know, so it's really kind of interesting. And besides, I've gotten to know Mike Barone, his big band, and he turns out to be a very nice guy. He was born in Detroit. The family moved to Cleveland, and he learned to play trombone, studied trombone with a guy who played with the Cleveland Symphony. So he's a very good trombone player. I asked him when I was chatting with him at the Lighthouse, because he liked my idea, since I use the word clone. I don't know if you don't know about my clones. Well, he because I had played a tune from his album, he started off his program at the Lighthouse talking about me being a disc jockey at KUCR. And he started talking about clones. He was amused at that. But at the intermission, he came down and sat next to us, and was very friendly. Said, yeah, he says, my big influence was Bill Holman, of course, and so and so and so and so. But he's just a very nice man. And then he invited us to go to this recording session, which was very interesting because the band was so well rehearsed. They didn't have to play anything more than twice, one tune, I think. And I think he did that on purpose, to give the engineer something to do. But anyway, it was interesting. So I have had a terrific life. Well, I wish music could conquer the world, for one thing. And I don't know, I just, the thing is, music brings people together. I can remember, I went to the concert of the Vienna Philharmonic one Sunday morning. They were doing a series of Beethoven, and I think it was the Beethoven Seventh Symphony. And but music moves people, you don't know, in unusual ways. I was standing next to this statuesque woman who was about a foot taller than I was, and at one point in the Seventh Symphony, she had tears streaming down her eyes, her cheek. And I bet that maybe she had reactions to the symphony with a loved one. This is after the war. And that maybe he was killed or something in the war and so on. So it has this power. And jazz has the same power. I think people really respond to it, like classical music. And, of course, some classical people wouldn't agree to that, I'm sure. But anyway, I'm not sorry for what I've done. No, I've just met so many wonderful people. Having gone to Northwestern, they advanced my name to get a Fulbright. And my composer friend happened to be chair of the committee. He had to recuse himself, but I submitted a couple of scores. And these guys were so impressed with my scores, how they looked. They had no idea, what they meant, but they liked the look. So I guess that helped me to get advanced.